pleasant good evening to everyone. We have visitors here tonight, and we appreciate your effort in coming out tonight. We've got some people here, I think, on vacation and people visiting who have just moved to the area. Got some people who are here for the first time, and we appreciate every one of you and hope that you'll stick around after and give us a chance to get to know you. Good to see all of our members here, and we've been so encouraged today by so many good things, the worship this morning. Appreciated that good lesson that Marty gave us this morning. And he mentioned in the sermon that there are a lot of people listening online, or we want you to know that you can listen to these sermons online. And if you did not get a chance to hear that lesson this morning on Elijah, I would encourage you to listen to that online or get a copy of the CD from Bill Christian. But just a very important message for all of us, an important message for me. I told Marty after that was a lesson that I needed to hear. Not a single one of us here is not affected by the culture. And we have to make these decisions every day to choose between serving idols or serving God. I asked the kids on the way home from church what they got from the lesson, and somebody said, "You got to be crazy to worship idols." And I think that's a pretty good commentary on the lesson. But we have to fight against that. Fight against that constantly. We're living in an age much like the age that Elijah lived in, and we've got to have that same determination that Elijah had. We're talking about leadership in a series that we've had going on for the last several weeks. We've looked at different characters in the Bible, David and Moses so far, and tonight we're going to be studying Nehemiah. You can't have a series on leadership without talking at some length about Nehemiah. And we're not going to say everything that could be said about him and his extraordinary ability to lead God's people. But so many lessons we can learn tonight from him. Qualities of leadership. The same qualities we've been talking about all along in David and Moses. I found as I've been working these PowerPoints, I'll just go in and plug in new scriptures, but I find that the points are almost identical in each lesson. The stories are different, but the qualities of leadership are the same. And what we're going to find in this last lesson, the last lesson we'll be looking at Jesus, is that all of these leaders are simply types of Christ. And they're helping us to get a sense of who Jesus is, ultimately, and giving us a pattern that we can follow in our lives. But not only are we going to look at leadership qualities, but we're also going to look at how Nehemiah handled opposition. And he faced a lot of opposition in his work. And then finally, we'll point the lesson to ourselves once again. We're going to begin in Nehemiah chapter 1. If you have your Bibles, I would encourage you to turn to page number 329 if you're using one of the Pew Bibles. But Nehemiah chapter 1, I need to tell you a little bit about the context before we start reading. This is near the end of the Old Testament history as we have it. The people of Israel had been in captivity for 70 years and then returned under the leadership of Zerubbabel. And then almost 100 years later, after the temple had been built, after Haggai and Zechariah, after several events had taken place, we see that the walls of the city of Jerusalem are still lying in ruins. Think about that. About 100 years. And the city is still vulnerable to attack. And walls around cities, especially a city the size of Jerusalem, were very, very critical, very important. And so this is not some minor thing. It's very important. And Nehemiah is still living in a foreign land. He's in the land of Persia at this time. He's cupbearer to the king. And he hears about the state of Jerusalem. And we're going to read about what he did when he heard that news. We'll begin reading in verse 1 of Nehemiah chapter 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Susa, the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, "The remnant there and the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire." As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love Him and keep His commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants. Confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you, even I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples, but if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell there. They are your servants and your people, whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delighted to fear your name and give success to your servant today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. I was the cupbearer to the king. And before we say anything else about Nehemiah, I want you to see one thing, and this may be one of the most important lessons you can take home tonight. Nehemiah cared. Nehemiah cared. He cared about God's people. So much so that when he heard about the state of Jerusalem, he wept. And he mourned for many days, praying with fasting. And he poured out his heart to God, asking God to make a way for him to go back and to help his people out. That's really one of the most important qualities we can learn about Nehemiah. He sat down and wept and mourned for days. It says, Nehemiah said, I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Notice, as we saw with Moses, that he identified with the people. He identified with his people, even though he was hundreds of miles away from Jerusalem. Even though he had never been to Jerusalem. Of course, he had heard stories. He had grown up learning about his people, learning about the temple, learning about all the great things that had happened there. But he was really a stranger in a foreign land. And he was a part of a kind of a privileged class, much like Moses was in Egypt. He was cupbearer to the king, which was not any kind of small, ordinary kind of job. He had a very important job in the kingdom. And no doubt was wealthy and had privileges and blessings. And yet when he heard about Jerusalem, he cared about them because they identified with them. We see his humility, another sign of a great leader. A leader is humble enough that when he sees a problem, he first looks to God, not to himself. He understands that he has a certain position and a certain opportunity because he is cupbearer to the king and he has access to the king. He understands that that puts him in a unique situation. But he doesn't necessarily put all of his confidence in his status and his position. He goes to God. He's humble enough to know he needs God's help. But he has compassion for the people. People, once again, he has never met. Compassion enough to try to do something very dangerous and daring. And he takes initiative. He doesn't sit there like a critic and say, well, why hasn't someone done something about this? Who's going to take care of this problem? He sees himself as a possible part of the solution. And finally, we see faith in Nehemiah. The same characteristics we saw in David. David showed faith and initiative and humiliation. We saw these same characteristics in Moses and really in every great leader of God, ultimately showing us who Christ is in all of these things. But going on to chapter 2, we see that Nehemiah, after some months, about 3 months, finally is given an opportunity. Finally, it seems like his prayer is being answered. Nehemiah was cupbearer to the king. And the cupbearer was the one who tasted the wine and ate the food before the king would eat or drink. And of course, that is an important position, seeing that the king often has many enemies. I understand that Artaxerxes' father was killed by his adversaries. And so there are a lot of people that want to see the king dead. And so you want to have someone that you can really trust in a position that could not, and someone that you don't believe would be easily bought, easily bribed by your enemy. Someone that you have placed so much trust that you're going to take the food from his hand, take the cup from his hand and eat and drink. And so that also meant that he had access to the king and would see the king frequently. On one of these occasions, Nehemiah is showing his sadness. Months after he heard about the condition of Jerusalem, finally he breaks down and he can't hide his emotions anymore before the king. And so we read in verse 1 of chapter 2, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. And the king said to me, why is your face sad, seeing you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart. Then I was very much afraid. And I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? And the king said to me, what are you requesting? So I prayed to the God of heaven. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it. And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, how long will you be gone and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and for the wall of the city and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. Nehemiah was a man just like you and me. I think sometimes we forget that when we read about these great heroes of faith. We read about Elijah up on Mount Carmel facing off 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of Asherah, and he just seems like Superman. Or we read about David facing Goliath, or Moses standing there at the Red Sea parting the waters, or Nehemiah doing these great deeds in rebuilding the city wall. And we think that there's something extraordinary beyond us. But you know, the Bible is very careful to point out that these men are just men. In James chapter 5, we're reminded that Elijah was a man with a nature like ours. He was just like you and me. But what made his prayers effective was that he was a righteous man praying to a God who listened to his prayers. Elijah was just like you and me, and so was Nehemiah. But what set Nehemiah apart from other men was the way that he lived his life. He was a man who was above reproach. You know why Daniel was placed in a position of authority in the kingdom? You want to know why Joseph was elevated to the chief steward of Potiphar's house and later put it over all the prisoners in prison? You want to know why Esther was allowed to appear before the king and had the ear of the king, and why Nehemiah had the respect of King Artaxerxes? It's because they were people of integrity. They were people who kept their word. They were people who did their job, and they did it well because they were working hard for the Lord and not for men. Nehemiah had been sick for 3 whole months, and the king didn't know it. And the reason why was because when he went before the king, he went to do his job. And he wouldn't just wear his emotions on his sleeve. He had one job to do, and he did it well. Now, there was one day when finally the king figured out that there was something wrong. He had been fasting for, who knows, months, perhaps. Finally, Nehemiah couldn't hide it anymore. But Nehemiah did his job, and he did it well. And great leaders work hard, not because they're trying to please men, but because they're trying to please God. And whether men may notice it or whether they may be rewarded for their work, after all that Joseph did serving Potiphar so well, what happened to him? He was thrown into prison, but he kept working hard at doing what was the right thing to do. And that's why he was continually elevated wherever he was. Because he did his job. And that's what Nehemiah did. And great leaders do their jobs. And they do it well. And that's the reason they have influence. That's the reason they gain trust, even in unbelievers like this king. He was a man of integrity. The king said, "Set me a time. How much time do you need?" And he set a time. And he abided by that time. You'll read chapters later that he came back because the king had appointed a certain amount of time. Sometime probably around a year or 2 years he set for the king. And he kept his word. He did what he was told. He was a man of courage. Yes, he was an ordinary man. And like any ordinary man, he was afraid. When the king asked him, "What's wrong?" it says, "I was very much afraid." And you would be too. But what motivated him to speak was the fact that he had been praying for days and weeks and months, and his trust was not in himself, his trust was in God. And God gave him the courage to speak up when he was afraid. He had faith in God. He had humility. Humility so that when he left the king's presence, he was not beating his breast and saying, "Look at what I have done. Aren't I really something?" The king wouldn't just listen to anybody. The king wouldn't just grant this petition to anybody. The king has not only granted me permission to go, but he's giving me all the supplies I need and even soldiers to protect us on the way. No, Nehemiah wasn't praising himself. "The king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me." He gave all credit to God. And so when we read the rest of chapter 2, we should not be at all surprised that not only was Nehemiah able to gain trust with the king, immediately when he came to Jerusalem, not knowing these people, this people not knowing him face to face, he was able to influence them and encourage them to do something that for generations had not been done, and that is rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. In verse 9, it says, "Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servants heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So I went to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I rose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I was out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate. And I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall, and I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing. And I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. Then I said to them, 'You see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision.' And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, 'Let us rise up and build.' So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant of Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, 'What is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?' Then I replied to them, 'The God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem.'" When Nehemiah came to Jerusalem, and understand that this was hundreds of miles, probably a 3 or even 4 month journey Imagine traveling by foot, by animal, not only taking yourself and your servants, but also traveling with all of these provisions, the food and supplies they needed, as well as the lumber and the building materials. This was a long, arduous task, not described in detail by Nehemiah, but in itself a feat. But when he comes to Jerusalem, after traveling for months, after praying for months about this situation, it says for 3 days he did nothing. Now, I don't believe he was really doing nothing. I suspect that more than likely he was praying, because that's what Nehemiah did. But at the end of those 3 days, he does not immediately go to the kings and the nobles and tell them about his great plans and all the things that he's going to do for Jerusalem. The first thing he does before he tells anybody is he goes around at night so that no one will see him, and he inspects the walls. He takes stock of the damage, of what's going to be necessary, of what needs to be done. And after taking all of that in and examining the situation and having a plan in his mind, he then goes before the people. You see, he understood the importance of trust. He understood that people aren't going to buy in to your plan, even if it's a godly plan, just because you say, "Hey, I think this is a good idea." Think about this. When he went before the king earlier in the chapter, and the king said, "Well, how much time do you need?" Nehemiah didn't say, "Well, I hadn't thought about that. Let me go think about this and I'll make some plans and I'll get back with you." And when the king said, "Well, what are you going to need?" Nehemiah said, "Well, I'm not really sure because I didn't think you were going to ask me and I haven't really thought all of that out, and so I'll get back with you later." No, he showed to the king that this was serious to him. Not just that he was concerned emotionally, but that he had spent mental time thinking about this. So that when he made these requests, the king was sure, well, Nehemiah is really concerned about this. And he's serious about this. And the same with the people. He didn't just come in and announce and say, "Hey, I'm here to save your city." He first went around to take stock of the situation, to see what was going on. He understood how important it was for people to trust him. And we need to understand that as leaders. We can't just come in and say, "Hey, I've been given this great position, and I'm here to tell you what to do, and so now listen to me." You have to gain people's trust. Whether that be in a church, or whether it be at work, or even if it's in your own home. And you have been given a place of responsibility, perhaps as a mother or as a father. You need to let the people who are influenced by you understand that you have thought seriously about them and about their situation. When you suggest things that they need to do, you need to have put in time thinking about what needs to be done and show them that you care enough to spend time doing that. Nehemiah understood that principle. And so he took stock of the situation. After a careful investigation, he went before the people. But he also understood that for people to buy into a godly vision, it doesn't need to be about you. There's lots of things Nehemiah could have said that would have impressed them about his own credentials. He could have told them about how he was cupbearer to the king, how he had this very important position in the kingdom. But that's not what his emphasis was on. He talked about the good hand of his God upon him. Leadership comes from God. And anything that we may do, any talents and abilities or position we may have, is by virtue of the fact that God has been gracious to bless us with those things. And we need to motivate people on a basis of that, on God and not on ourselves. Notice the progression in this passage. The call that Nehemiah makes, "Come, let us build," is based on the divine hand of God upon him. "I told them of the hand of my God." That's the reason they listened. They said, "Let us rise up and build," and strengthen their hands to the work because they first saw that God's hand was in this. I don't care how talented you are, how impressive you are in your eloquence, or in your abilities, and whatever you might do at work or at school or in the church or anything else, if people can't see that you're first putting your trust in God, you can't exert godly influence upon anyone. Oh, you can force people to do what you say, but you can't lead them the way Nehemiah led, putting dependence and trust in God. But as we see at the end of chapter 2, even at the very beginning of this project, it was not without obstacles. The first thing that we see is ridicule. The two men, Sanballat and Tobiah, say, well, what is this thing that you're doing? Making fun of what they were attempting to do. No doubt, perhaps, making them think about the fact that this hadn't been done for years and years. Generations of Israelites had lived there and dwelt in Jerusalem and had done nothing. Almost 100 years, or perhaps more than 100 years, these walls had lied in ruins. And now they decide, when they see Nehemiah trying to build the walls, to make fun of him. In chapter 4, they say, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of heaps of rubbish and burn ones at that? They said, well, if a fox were to jump up on this wall, it'd fall down. Ridicule is a powerful weapon the enemy will use. And we need to respond the same way Nehemiah did. He said, the God of heaven will make us prosper. Again, he didn't put it on himself and say, well, I'm well qualified for this job. I've got organizational skills, leadership skills, all these skills that I've developed in my years in the kingdom in Persia. Hey, I'm cupbearer to the king. No, he said, the reason we're going to succeed is because God is with us. And when finally we see them mocking him again, he says in prayer, hear, O God, for we are despised. He turns to God in prayer. And you know, the way we oftentimes respond is a negative response. Not just in defending ourselves, but in attacking in return. But that was not Nehemiah's response. Not that he didn't see that it was necessary that Tobiah and Sanballat be punished for what they were doing. Notice what he says in the rest of verse 4 in chapter 4. He says, hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads, and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders. Now, Nehemiah understood that they needed to be dealt with, but notice that he didn't take it into his own hands. He didn't see himself as the one to go and make them be quiet and to punish them for their sin. He saw that as something that God should do. When people ridicule you for serving the Lord, don't revile them in return. Don't try to seek personal vengeance for what they're doing. Simply go about your job, do your work, and let God handle it. Pray to God, and He'll take care of the situation. But at the end of the day, it says in verse 6, so we built the wall. The best thing you can do when people make fun of you is just get back to work. Go get some mortar, get another brick, and just keep on laying blocks. That's what Nehemiah did. But we also see discouragement, and discouragement from several sources in chapter 4. In chapter 4, we understand that the project is about halfway finished. They got the wall up to about half of its height. And all of the enthusiasm of chapter 2... And chapter 3 is a wonderful chapter we don't have time for tonight. But chapter 3, we see that a lot of people are involved in this work. Over 30 names are mentioned as working on different sections of the wall. Even the nobles and their daughters were involved in this. Perfumers, who probably don't know a thing about building, are involved in this work. Everyone's getting involved. And that's the way projects often begin, is there's a lot of enthusiasm and joy and happiness and excitement about what's being done. But eventually all of that excitement wears off and people start getting tired and people start getting discouraged because of hindrances and enemies come in and discourage us as well. And we see all of that happening in chapter 4. It says in chapter 4 and verse 8, they all plotted to come together and fight against Jerusalem. Now Sanballat and Tobiah are not just taunting and jeering and making fun. Now they're picking up swords and they're out there threatening them to stop the work. We see discouragement from friends. The ones who were around Judah said to us 10 times, "You must return to us. This is suicide. You're going to get us all in trouble. The armies are coming. You've got to stop." And even from within, there was discouragement. "The strength of those who bear the burdens is failing," they said, in Jerusalem. "There's too much rubble. By ourselves, we will not be able to rebuild the wall." It's interesting what happens when you start to get tired, when you start to get fatigued, when you start to have frustration, and when you start to be afraid, and you start to get tired. It's not like the rubble wasn't there when they started. But once they saw all of the enemies surrounding them, and when they started to see people getting tired, you know, the nobles that started out so strong, they're starting to get blisters in their hands. And the perfumers who aren't used to heavy work, their backs are aching. And everyone's getting tired and weak and weary, and all of a sudden they start saying to Nehemiah, "We just need to stop. This is crazy. This is suicide. We're going to be killed if we continue." I think Nehemiah's response is very important for all of us to see, because we're all going to face that at times, either in our families or in the church. There's going to be times when the godly vision that we cast, the godly direction we took our family, is going to be met with opposition. There's going to be times when we get weary in doing good. And that's what defines a leader. Nehemiah was defined not just by getting everybody started. He was defined by his ability to keep everyone going. I want you to notice how he did that. Once again, he prayed. He began by praying to God. Who else is he going to go to? He understands that he's not there because of his own skill or ability. He knows the reason why he's there. So he goes back to God. He doesn't forget who gave him the ability to get started. And he knows if he's going to finish this project, it's going to be because of God. And then he planned. He didn't just stop with prayer. He stationed the people with swords and spears and bows. He told some of the people, "Well, you go out there and protect us. We're going to put you out there in the field, and everybody else keep working." At one point, there were workers who were building with one hand, and with the other hand, they held a sword. He put out a plan and said, "Okay, well, I understand there's a threat out there, there's a danger, but we can handle this because God is with us." And that's the most important thing. They had lost sight of the vision. They had lost sight of the reason why they were so enthusiastic to begin with. He said, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." He reminded them that it's not about them. You see, that's what was happening. They said, we can't do it. There's too much rubble. Our strength is failing. We're getting tired. We're getting weak. The enemies are out there. And the reason why they were talking like that is because they had stopped praying. They had stopped focusing on God, and they were focusing on themselves. And that's when a leader has to rise up and say, "No, we can't do this by ourselves, but God can do it. And if He's with us, we will continue to the very end and finish this, no matter what our enemies might do." We got to put the focus back on God. And at the end of the day, we got to get back to work. We all return to the wall, each to his own work. Well, what can we learn for ourselves today? What are the take-home lessons? Well, let me say, first of all, you need to start tomorrow. Tomorrow morning, Monday morning, by being a leader at work. I remember when I decided I was going to start preaching. I was in my second year of college. I had gone to Auburn to become an engineer. Halfway through, I decided, no, I want to preach. And a good friend of ours, who was also a preacher, was visiting. And I told him, and he's twice my age, same age as my father. And I told him, I said, "Tommy, I've decided to forego secular work and be a preacher." And he stopped me right there. And he said, "David, to a child of God, there is no such thing as secular work." And I had no idea what he was talking about. And he didn't really explain it to me. It was not until later when I was reading Ephesians chapter 6 and Colossians chapter 3 and read about slaves who did their work not as men pleasers but as servants of the Lord, doing their work for the Lord and not to men. Not till then that I understood what he was talking about. Nehemiah didn't work so hard to be the cupbearer to please the king. Joseph didn't work so hard for Potiphar just because he was hoping to be the chief steward. Esther wasn't diligent at doing what she did and gaining trust in the king just to please him. The reason these men and women of God worked hard at their professions is because they were doing it for the Lord. And that's where you become a godly leader. God uses what we may call secular positions of vocation. He uses those things as training grounds to prepare us for greater work. You know, you may be stuck at a job that you think is a dead-end job and just see yourself as doing something just to earn a paycheck. Stop that. Don't think of your job as just a job. I don't care if you're digging ditches. Do it with all your might. Do it for the Lord. When He tells you to be there at 8 a.m., you be sure you're there at 7:45, ready to work. And when it's time to go home, then you can leave the job. But until then, you work. And don't spend all day talking to your buddies at work, just talking about sports or politics or whatever. Don't spend all your time at work playing on the internet. Work hard. You're there to do a job. Nehemiah understood that. He worked hard at his job. Even when he was not feeling good, he went to his job with a smile on his face. He wasn't going to let the king know that he was sorrowful. Do your job. Be a leader at work. And it may just be that God has something planned for you that would blow your mind, be beyond anything that you think you could ever do. Because if you show yourself dependable in the little things, that's when God entrusts you with something that truly is big. Be a leader at work. We were at camp up in North Georgia, and the whole week was about Nehemiah. And on the last day, J.D. Copeland, whom many of you know, whom we're going to be supporting up in New York City in September, J.D. got up and told the kids that if there were one thing that he would put on his desk, if he had a desk, to remind him of what is most important as a preacher, he said, it's this word right here. Leaders are great leaders because they care. I tell you, when we stop being a great leader, it's when we stop caring. And that's easy to do when your kids are driving you nuts and you're tired and you're worn out. That's easy to do when you've been working all day and you come home and everyone's fussing and fighting. It's easy to do when your boss has been hard on you, wearing you out, accusing you of things that you haven't done and everybody's giving you a hard time. It's hard to do when you're serving in the church and all you get is criticism from others. It's real easy to stop caring. But great leaders don't do that. Great leaders always care. And they keep working. And they keep toiling. And they keep bringing the people back to the wall and saying, let's get back to work. Let's keep praying. Let's remember what this is all about. Remember the Lord and build for your sons and your daughters and your wives and for your homes. Remember what this is all about. And sometimes you need to say those things to the people you're leading just to remind yourself of what it's all about. That it's not about you. It's not about your convenience. Nehemiah didn't go to Jerusalem to be convenient. Nehemiah didn't leave a nice cushy job to be comfortable. That's not what leaders do. Leaders get in there and work because they care. But you know, there's times when you need to just rise up, and this should say, and build. There's one blank in your outline there. That's what this should read. I changed my mind about the title here. You know, I don't know what the walls of your life that are broken down might be. It may be just some personal walls. Marty talked about some walls that break down in our own hearts because we're faltering between two positions. We can't decide whether we're going to serve God or serve idols. But it may be the walls of your home are crumbling down, or the walls of your friends, or the walls of your brethren here at Embry Hills. Whatever walls you see that are broken, and when you see an opportunity to go and build, don't sit around and wait for somebody else to do it. Don't just sit there like a critic and complain about the walls being broken down. Can you just imagine hearing in Jerusalem for 100 years, when's somebody going to do something about these walls? Boy, that's a real problem. Sanballat and Tobiah over there making fun of us, and they could attack us at any time. I'm sure there was a lot of complaining, and there were a lot of critics, and there were a lot of people that went to their graves complaining about the walls of Jerusalem. But it wasn't until someone who had never been to Jerusalem finally said, let's do something about this. Don't wait for somebody else to do it. You be the one to rise up and build. You be the one to stand up on all the rubble and say, we need to do something about this. Where's the mortar? Where are the bricks? Let's get started. Don't look to yourselves. Look to God. And that really is the most important thing. And this has been the last point in every lesson. Be sure that you lead to the glory of God. Nehemiah cared for his people because he cared about God. The walls being down around Jerusalem were a disgrace to the name of God. And Nehemiah cared so much about God, he decided he was going to rebuild those walls. What's going to motivate you and what's going to motivate me to finally get up off of the pew and do something about the walls that are broken around us is going to be when we decide, you know what, it's not about my comfort. And it's not about my convenience. The honor of God is at stake because of what's happening to me, what's happening to my family, what's happening to my friends, what's happening to Embry Hills. The honor of God is at stake. And so I'm going to rise up and build. That's what makes a great leader. Get your songbooks. We're going to sing a song of encouragement. George Bernard Shaw said, this is the true joy of life. The being used up for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one. Being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish clot of ailments and grievances. Complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. You want to find true joy in your life? Understand that it's not about you. Understand that it's not about the church or your family or your job, your boss, your co-workers serving you and making you happy. That's not what life is all about. True joy can only be found in life when you selflessly say, I'm here to serve others to the glory of God. And whether you succeed or fail, whatever your standard of success or failure might be, you're going to find true joy and you're going to be rewarded because those are the kinds of people that God is looking for. And in fact, the reality is you can never fail when you put God first in your life and you seek to glorify Him in whatever you're doing. There's no such thing as failure because God will not allow you to fail. It doesn't mean that you'll save your family and save everyone you're trying to reach, but you will not fail as long as you're serving God. If you're not a child of God, though, you need to look very carefully at your walls because they are in ruins. And there's really nothing you can do about your walls until you first come to the Master Builder, until you first come to the chief cornerstone, Jesus Christ, and allow Him to be the foundation for your life. He came to this earth and died, the greatest servant leader, to redeem you, to make you one of His own, to make you a chosen stone, precious, to be built up for a spiritual house. And you can begin that life tonight by repenting of your sins, turning your life over to Him, giving up self and pride, and saying to the Lord, I'm from this day forward going to be a worker, someone building walls to your glory. And if you'll be baptized, immersed in water tonight, you'll be forgiven of all of your sins and be made something precious and glorious for God. So if you're subject to this invitation, please come as we stand and sing.